From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Donald Spoto joins us this week. The author of 24 books, Donald Spoto is the authority on the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock. His first book, The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, was published in 1976. It carefully examines each of the director's films, illuminating the themes that pervade Hitchcock's work. Dr. Spoto's full-length biography, The Dark Side of Genius, The Life of Alfred Hitchcock, was first published in 1983. After many biographies of film stars and theological studies, Donald Spoto returns to Hitchcock with his new book, Spellbound by Beauty, Alfred Hitchcock and His Leading Ladies. It's an uncompromising look at the obsessions that drove one of Hollywood's most accomplished filmmakers. Donald Spoto, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, Gary, as always.
Dr. Spoto, having already written so much about Hitchcock, although he is an important and complex character, but what made you decide there was more to say?
My feeling is, Gary, that when I had a look again at The Dark Side of Genius, it became very clear to me that the material that I was asked to withhold by many of the people I interviewed now required, after the passage of 25 years, to be set forth. Specifically, speaking with people like Ingrid Bergman and Grace Kelly, I'm naming only the most famous among them, and a significant number of the leading ladies and some of the leading men as well, who asked me, please not to quote them right now. Let's remember that when I wrote the biography, there were two things that were compelling. First of all, it was virtually immediately after Hitchcock's death. And secondly, it was my first biography. There have been 17 since then, but it was my first. And I must admit that while I stand by every assessment and appreciation I made of his work, I too felt so much in awe of Hitchcock's status as a great artist that I tended to diminish some of the key elements that describe not only his pain and his loneliness and his fear in life, but also the pain that he caused many other people. And as I revisited that material, by going over all those interviews, by paying particular attention to the specific things that people asked me not to disclose just yet, because it was so close to Hitch's death, I felt that the time had come to set forth a kind of cautionary tale, which this book is.
How does Hitchcock compare as a filmmaker or director with his contemporaries, directors like John Ford or George Cukor or Frank Capra?
Hitchcock's personal vision informs so much of his films. First and foremost, from the very earliest days of his silent films made in Germany and the United Kingdom before he came to America, they were hugely successful commercially. The more successful they were, the more leeway, the more freedom he was given to do what he wanted in his pictures. So that is the first thing, that the commercial success allowed him the control and the freedom. The second element is that he, from the start, recognized, and he said this even when he was making silent films, that the name of the director was more important than anything. And he made sure that his name was known, not only by, you know, inserting himself in his cameo roles and his pictures, this is the artist signing the canvas, you see, but also that success enabled him to attract writers and actors and technicians who were willing, in fact, were delighted to go along with and collaborate with him on this vision that he had. Because it led to their success also. If you could put on your resume that you'd worked for Alfred Hitchcock and thus in such a picture or pictures, this was extremely valuable for your career. Now, I don't know if I'm addressing, you made another point in your remarks, that I think if you consider someone like John Ford, Howard Hawks, These are estimable directors who told wonderful stories, but generally they are not, their films are not keys to their own personalities or characters. They were contract directors who worked more or less successfully within this genre or that genre. Hitchcock was remarkably personal because he was remarkably successful. And he was remarkably successful, and this is the second point to be made, he was remarkably successful because these themes, these passions, these obsessions that he described are not just his own. More or less profoundly, they address dreams and nightmares and fantasies and passions and yearnings and complexes that every human being has. In other words, Hitchcock is just like you and me, only more so.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's responsible for his enduring popularity. Here we are, almost 30 years after his death, and you can still find his pictures playing all over the world, on all television stations. You know, the books continue to glut the market. There's got to be a reason for that. And I think the reason has to do not primarily with himself and his own psychological history, but with the fact that his films address perennial issues of human significance.
Now, well, let's get into that. Now, you know, Hitchcock was rather corpulent, you know, throughout his life, and I saw him once at close range, and he was not an attractive man by any means. And many of his films portray a kind of a darkly sinister view of sex, and according to your book, he wasn't very nice to anyone, but especially his leading ladies. So what were his attitudes toward women and sex?
Hitchcock's attitude towards women, towards sex, towards sexual activity, was extremely complex. And, of course, that's the major theme of this 300-page book. And I don't want to reduce it to a little Freudian synthesis or syndrome.
Yes.
But let me say this by way of you know, a provocative introduction. When we look at Hitchcock's life, with his constantly losing battle against morbid obesity, when we look at the kinds of jokes that he played and jokes that he told and the way in which we treated people, there's no way we can avoid not only seeing more clearly the darkly sinister attitude toward women in his films, who are for the most part strangled when they're not stabbed to death, but we also are aware of a profound conflict in himself, a conflict that he spoke about. He hated actors. He hated people who were beautiful. He knew that he was forever shut off from any kind of intimacy. I mean, he told me himself, and I wasn't the only one, but he told me himself that, you know, he just didn't have the ability to kick off his shoes and put his feet up and, you know, sort of disclose himself to people, to share, to say, oh, let me tell you about my day. I feel so frustrated. He might have done that with his wife. We'll never know. They kept themselves to themselves. But he hadn't the gift of friendship. And that's the saddest thing that we can say about any life. To a person, you get dozens of actors who worked with him who are in awe of his talent and who might even have been glad to work for him, but they didn't know him, and they say as much. Now, it's not important for Hitchcock to have been a nice guy, backslapping actors and taking them to lunch and all that, but he kept them all on a terrible string of ignorance about what he felt. The classic example, to take just one, is his treatment of Doris Day during The Man Who Knew Too Much. And by the way, let me add that Doris Day is one of the great talents in American movie history, so far as I'm concerned.
She was a very natural actress.
She's an extremely natural and an extremely persuasive actress who not only was enchanting in a series of movie musicals, but who was dramatically compelling in pictures like Storm Warning and Love Me or Leave Me, for Hitchcock in The Man Who Knew Too Much, in Midnight Lace. I mean, this is an actress of an extraordinary range and profound emotional, compelling emotional gifts in her talent. But for more than half the shooting of that picture, Hitchcock never said a word to her. He said action and he said cut. And she was so upset, believing that she was displeasing him, that she went to Hitchcock and she said, "Mr. Hitchcock, I know you're not happy. Let me withdraw and you can get someone whom you like and you think could do better in the picture." She wasn't being sarcastic. And he said, "What makes you think I don't like your performance?" And she said, "You haven't said a word to me so far in the first 8 weeks of filming." And he said, "If I didn't like what you were doing, I would have said something." And he turned and walked away. Now, that's not enough. Severe, important demands were being put on her in this magnificent but complicated and difficult role. It would have been nice for her to have heard just once, "Doris, that was a really lovely scene." But he couldn't do it. He did the same thing with Julie Andrews. And quite late in his life and late in his career, he said, "Well, Doris Day and Julie Andrews were not appropriate because, after all, they were just singers."
Why would he have cast either of them if he believed that?
Well, in the case of Doris Day, he cast her because she was big box office. In the case of Julie Andrews, he didn't have any choice. In 1965, the year after the release of Marnie, Hitchcock was under enormous pressure to use big stars. And Lou Wasserman at Universal made it quite clear to him that he had better take Julie Andrews and Paul Newman, neither of whom he wanted. And his indifference to them showed all during the production. I mean, I spent a very important day with Paul Newman, who was very generous and quite frank in discussing the circumstances of making Torn Curtain. And I think a lesser actor would have been left with crushing memories. Happily, you know, Mr. Newman is a man of enormous prudence and judgment, and he just sort of, you know, knew that the script was bad and wasn't cowed by Hitch's rather cavalier treatment of him. Whereas, you know, Julie Andrews felt that it was an early mark against her. She's wrong because she did so many other wonderful things at the time and since then.
We're talking with Donald Spoto, and his most recent book is Spellbound by Beauty, Alfred Hitchcock and His Leading Ladies, and his recent books also include biographies of Alan Bates and Joan of Arc. Well, obviously he had a type of woman that he liked, since almost every woman between the early days and Tippi Hedren falls into that type, but the first one, I think, is Nova Pilbeam, and she's so delightful in Young and Innocent. She had a beautiful face, and she was also a child actress in The Man Who Knew Too Much, but she becomes the star in Young and Innocent. Tell us a little bit about her and Hitchcock's treatment of her.
Well, Nova Pilbeam, who I'm happy to report is still alive and well at 90 or 90-something.
Did she speak to you for her book?
No, she hasn't. She doesn't give interviews. She has been out of movies for about 60 years. She has reveled in her private life. She had a very tragic incident, and that shortly after Young and Innocent, in fact. As a young woman, she fell in love with the assistant director on the Hitchcock film and on a couple of films afterwards, named Penn Tennyson, who was a descendant of the great poet. And they were married. She was, I believe, 19, and he was 22. They married, and in the earliest days of the Second War, he was flying on duty in the British Air Ministry, and he was killed. And this was the love of her life. And she did a few films after that with half her heart, and then retired permanently from screen acting. I have as high a regard for Nova Pilbeam as you do. Unfortunately, her name carries no currency with people who don't know the finer points of movie history.
Yes,
she was magnificent.
Young and Innocent, I don't even think it's on DVD, or I don't know if it is or not.
It is on DVD, I'm happy to report, in a beautiful print.
Okay.
And, in fact, it's in the public domain now. Young and Innocent is a magnificent motion picture. You're quite right to single it out. Hitch was very admiring of her performance as a 14-year-old for him in The Man Who Knew Too Much, first version, 1934, and then brought her back at 17 to be the leading lady in Young and Innocent. And she gave a funny, warm, poignant, emotionally complex performance that is, you know, responsible in many ways for the glory of that comic thriller. His own attitude to her, which she, in the one interview she gave on Hitchcock to Brian McFarlane, the Australian interviewer, she said that he could be naughty, a gentle word, but one that's repeated often by the British actresses who worked with him. He could be very naughty. And when McFarlane asked, how was that, he talked about the scene at the end, which foreshadows the end of North by Northwest, among other pictures, in which the heroine is suspended over an abyss and pulled up by one hand by the leading man, the romantic leading man. And she said he did this so often on the studio set that she felt her shoulder was going to be dislocated, your arm was going to come out of socket, and, you know, he could be puckish and difficult. Things like that. And one has to ask, and that's the least incident that we could point to. One has to ask, and it started 10 years before that, 12 years before that, with June in The Lodger, with the manacles, the handcuffs, which Hitchcock, of course, was obsessed with bondage. This occurs throughout his picture. The handcuffing of people occurs throughout his career. And he talked to Francois Truffaut in the famous book of interviews at great length about the sexual connotation, the sexual inference implications of bondage. Now, these days, bondage, of course, has become almost a, my heavens, it's in some quarters, it's almost a respectable club. But that shows you the times we live in.
Yeah.
But Hitchcock said, you know, it's very exciting. There's a sexual element in this. It's very exciting and arousing. And maybe I'm not the only one, but my reaction to that is, it is? no accounting for taste. But I'm not making this up. One has only to look at the whole record of his films to see this.
Well, we're speaking with Donald Spoto, and he's a Hitchcock historian as well as biographer of many great film stars and also theological subjects. In The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, you talk about the themes that surface. Would you say that one of these themes, the whole idea of that interaction with men and women, is sort of the main theme that surfaces through all of his films, and possibly, I guess, the film is Vertigo, it's the major theme?
Well, I think you're entirely correct, Gary, and again, you're putting your finger on something that needs to be explored. When I talk about these things, I'm not talking about my interpretation, quote-unquote, of Hitchcock, or reading something into them. I simply invite people to look at all the pictures and to see for themselves that these things are in the films. I'm not inventing them or talking about things that don't exist. I have often been accused of writing about Hitchcock's psychology. I don't write about Hitchcock's psychology. I write about Hitchcock as we see him in his work. And we see him in his work as we see few other filmmakers in their work, few other artists in their work. And you're quite right when you say that this overarching interest in complex human relationships is a major theme of his films, and that's one of the things that makes them so enduring. It's one of the things by which they pass the test of time, because the complex interaction of characters, especially men and women for the sake of drama, is a perennial theme. It's something that interests people in every generation, in every culture, at every point in history. That's why it doesn't go out of fashion. You mentioned Vertigo. You're entirely correct. When I began my first book 34 years ago, The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, and it was my very first book, and I was untried and unknown, and I began to speak to Hitchcock's people. It was especially Samuel Taylor who gave him the brilliant script for Vertigo, with whom I wanted to speak. And Sam Taylor, who subsequently became a great friend, Sam said to me, look at the picture and you see Alfred Hitchcock's most direct spiritual testament. It was a personal film for him to make, and everybody on the picture knew it. And the more I spoke to people, and the more I saw Vertigo in terms of his other films, it became clear to me that that film, which I place very, and I'm not the only one, I place very high on the list of greatest films of all time. It is Vertigo that is a film about Alfred Hitchcock taking an unknown girl, transforming her, forcing her to dye her hair blonde, picking the clothes, picking the makeup, training her, rehearsing her, to use the words of the dialogue, telling her exactly how to walk, what to say, and what to do. It was about Hitchcock working with his actresses. Vertigo is one of the most chilling pictures because it shows us the extreme to which obsession goes. It is also among those works of high art that touches upon something dangerous in every human relationship. When Jimmy Stewart says to Kim Novak, please change the color of your hair, it can't matter to you, and she replies, all right, I'll do it. Will you love me? Yes, he replies. All right, I'll do it. I don't care about me anymore. Now, those words or variants on them are heard every day in the staterooms, the boardrooms, and the bedrooms of people all over the world. And this is one of the elements, maybe the most important element, that makes Vertigo such an important motion picture. It's a film about one's denial or abnegation of oneself. In this regard, Vertigo may also be Hitchcock's most sympathetic treatment of a woman, because the character of Judy Barton, magnificently played by Kim Novak, the character of Judy Barton allows herself to be changed into something she isn't, not once but twice. First of all, by her lover, Gavin Elster, played by Tom Helmore, and then by the demented character of John Scotty Ferguson, played by James Stewart. Twice, in order to please a man, she allows herself to be changed into something she isn't. It can only lead to her death. In that regard, this is Renaissance tragedy.
Did Hitchcock make a conscious decision each time a theme overwhelmed a film? I can't think of a better word, but for instance, in The Birds, that's the sort of the culmination of using bird imagery in his films, which we see in many of his films, notably Psycho. Did he think, okay, it's time for the birds to kind of, or it's time for the obsession of Vertigo to just take over this next movie, or it's time for The Wrong Man to take over, or the time for color to be in Topaz, or whatever?
The Wrong Man brings to a head his fear of enclosure, his fear of prison, and fear of being arrested even though he's innocent, which he said went back to a childhood event of being locked up in a cell for some little bit of mischief at home. Whether or not this happened can never be determined, but it made a brilliant story for the press. If it happened, then he's telling us that he believed his parents, his father particularly, were enormously cruel people to do this to a child, lock him in a prison cell for 5 minutes. I mean, that's just beyond cruel. That's child abuse of a notorious sort. But I'm not sure that it ever did happen. Hitch knew a good story and knew what the press needed. You know, he told the same stories over and over and over again because they were good for his popularity.
And they were funny.
And they were funny. Or he thought they were funny, and he gave the press. Oh, you know, he got locked in a cell as a child. Therefore, he always tells stories about innocent men being arrested.
Right.
Well, that's just Freudian claptrap. If he knew this throughout his adult life, he confronted it and would have dismissed it. You know, to say, oh, well, you know, I'm making all these films because I was locked in a cell as a child. This is too facile to be credible. I don't think that when Hitchcock uses his themes in a capitulative moment, that is, that they reach their zenith, their high point, and this is not a conscious decision by an artist. If it were, it would be far too calculated and artistically unsuccessful. Hitchcock was too much of an artist to say, oh, well, now I must do a picture in which this will be my final statement on thus and such. No. It's a question, in his case, of dealing secondarily or subtly or repressively with themes over and over and over and over and over and over for decades. And finally, they reach the boiling point. In The Birds, you are quite right. Bird imagery appears in just about every single Hitchcock picture before he films The Birds in 1962.
And does it continue after The Birds?
And of course, The Birds is necessitated by his previous picture, Psycho, which is just so overloaded with bird imagery. It's about a bird, the, you know, anglicism for a pretty young woman, a bird, named Marion Crane from Phoenix, who gets stuffed, which is, of course, a crude word for sex, attacked sexually, by a boy whose hobby is stuffing birds. And in the novel on which it's based, by Robert Bloch, the character of Norman Bates stuffs all kinds of animals, but Hitchcock made it only stuffing birds.
Mm-hmm.
Why? He has the character say why. Because they're passive to begin with. Well, come on, you don't have to be what is the phrase in America, a rocket scientist. You don't have to be brilliant to see what he's talking about here. It's all sort of currency for sex. But Psycho makes necessary, as it were, the explosion of bird imagery at last in The Birds, and therefore it doesn't have the primacy in the four final films that follow. Marnie, Torn Curtain, Topaz, Frenzy, and Family Plot.
Well, of those 50-some films, there are a few that are not so great, but most of them are pretty fantastic.
It's remarkable. When you look at the 52 films, I think you could make a case that more than 30 of them are deathless films which continue to entertain and shock and astonish and provide food for thought and for feeling, more important, with audiences, you know, from Tipperary to Thailand, decades and decades later.
The book is called Spellbound by Beauty, Alfred Hitchcock and His Leading Ladies, the author Donald Spoto. Thank you so much for talking with us tonight.
It's been a delight for me.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show. I'll be back again soon with another great program. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. As always, thanks go to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Gary Shapiro.